Future-proof gold from News Talk.
Now, I am white. You may not have known that. Maybe you couldn't tell from my voice, but I'm white. And Serena Williams is black. And for better or worse, we humans seem to have this compulsion to categorize ourselves in these terms, in medical forms, in our passports. Why? And what merit do any of these categories of race really have? Well, Gavin Evans is the author of Skin Deep: Journeys in the Divisive Science of Race. He joins me now. Gavin, where does the idea about race, where does the idea that we are different races come from? I mean, I'm struck by the fact that young children, it seems to me, have no idea of race. And you might text me in and prove me different. But I remember my three-year-old, he was talking to me about something a boy in his class said. And I said, which boy? And I looked across the room and he said, the one in the red top. Now, there was only one black child in the room and it was the boy in the red top. But my son just didn't see his race at all. He didn't see the colour that we see. Where did that idea of race begin, do we know?
Well, you're quite right there. Young children don't have a concept of race. There's nothing innate even in the concept of race, never mind in race itself. It really goes back to, in its current form at least, to the 18th century and 19th century, when people who were, I guess, scientists for their time, started to categorize people in terms of appearance. So because they didn't know about genes at that stage, so they looked instead initially at things like skin color, at hair type, at the width of their noses, and so on. So, and they came up with this idea that there are three primary races: Caucasoid, which is white people; Mongoloid, which is people from East Asia; and Negroid, which is people who have an African origin. So that idea then emerged. And later in the 19th century, you had various people who added to that by starting to try and measure skulls. And they would fill them with birdshot and measure their capacity, and decided that different shapes of heads, different sizes of heads, reflected different race groups and reflected different levels of intelligence. So that idea then started to emerge. I mean, of course, what we now know is that sort of bigger people tend to have bigger heads, and smaller people have smaller heads, but that has no bearing on intelligence. But they didn't know that at that stage. Then in the 20th century, and really actually the late 19th century, but particularly in the 20th century, race science really kicked in, this consciousness of race. And then people began to define not just the measurements of heads, but what's inside those heads. And the prime method of that was IQ tests.
The outward appearance of different races is something that, you know, if you stop someone in the streets, they would be able to categorize. And yet, when we look beyond those facial differences between, say, white, Asian, black, and so on, we cannot see evidence of these differences in genes. It seems sort of reasonable at that time that we might look at people who looked different and think that their underlying biology was much different, because we focus so much on the face as human beings.
Yeah, that's quite right. But even if you look at those superficial characteristics, and those are very minor characteristics in terms of genetic mutations, if we look at skin color, at nose type, at eyelid folds and hair type, there's no consistency there. In the same area of Africa, you might get the darkest skin color and the narrowest noses, for example.
Yeah.
And there's huge variation. I mean, within Africa itself, you have the tallest and the shortest people, the widest and the narrowest noses. You have light skin and dark skin. So even at that level, the differences that were supposedly there for race groups don't stack up. But when you look at genetics, then you get a different picture, because what we find is that throughout Africa, there's much more genetic variation than there is in the diaspora of all the people who left Africa. And there's a very simple reason for that. Small groups left Africa and then they bred and the populations grew. So they came from a smaller genetic pool, whereas those within Africa came from a much bigger genetic pool. So scientists who've looked at genetic variation have found that on average, and it is a very broad average, but one has to generalize, people at least from West Africa have 33% more genetic variation than those, for example, of Europe or the United States.
Wow.
So there's much more genetic variation even within Africa than between, say, Italians and Norwegians. The gap between Italians and Norwegians is much narrower than the gap between different parts of the San community in Southern Africa, because they are the oldest in terms of continuous cultures. They go back the furthest, and so there's more genetic variation among them. There's also huge overlap in just about everything between the so-called different races in terms of key genetic markers. So race as a term that can be used by the police when they say they're looking for a Caucasian man who's 6'3" tall, that might be useful, but as a scientific category, race doesn't make any sense anymore. And scientists talk about much smaller population groups rather than a race.
But there have been, even in the just last 10 years, a number of prominent thinkers and writers who have published books that have been on bestseller lists that sort of seem to draw from this idea that race and IQ are linked in some way. I'm thinking of Nicholas Wade and Charles Murray and even Steven Pinker, as you mentioned in your book.
That's quite correct. They do believe that. And I think the reason they believe that is because they have a fundamental flaw, each of those people, in their concept of IQ. If you look at the Ashkenazi Jewish one, which is all three of them hold to that idea, so maybe that's a good one to summarize. They said, well, that first of all, that Ashkenazi Jewish people on average score higher in IQ tests. Now, what they don't seem to be aware of is that through several IQ tests, including one that was done among all the servicemen in the First World War, so it was a huge volume of people who were tested, Ashkenazi Jewish people scored the low average on IQ tests. But by the Second World War, they were scoring average or above average, and now are about 8 points above average. So there's been no genetic change there. What has happened is they've been more exposed to the kind of abstract logic that IQ tests score. The other argument is that Ashkenazi Jewish people were genetically isolated, and therefore intelligence genes could take root. Now, I looked into that. Actually, my father was an Ashkenazi Jew, and I looked into that, and Ashkenazi Jewish people were not genetically isolated in Europe. One very large study found that 80% of the maternal, the matrilineal or maternal genetic link came from European populations and not from the Middle East. So there was a lot more interbreeding, if you call it that, in the Ashkenazi Jewish community than they acknowledge. And then the third argument they put forward was that these Ashkenazi Jewish diseases were part of natural selection for intelligence, and that people with these diseases are probably more intelligent than others. Well, various studies have found they're not more intelligent than others, and also that these diseases did not emerge from natural selection. Instead, they came from genetic drift. And if you look at another community in Kenya, where IQ tests have been done on children, in half a generation, their IQs went up by, I think it was 23 points. And that was a result of better nutrition, better education, more exposure to abstract logic, which is what IQ tests are testing. So the fact that one group tests above average in IQ tests on average tells us absolutely nothing about their innate intelligence. All that it tells us is something about the kind of education, the kind of family life, the kind of exposure to abstraction that group has. They stick, despite overwhelming evidence, to a very dated idea that IQ measures innate intelligence, that it is primarily genetic, and that therefore, and there's no logical connection in terms of the therefore point, therefore differences in average IQs between population groups must have something to do with genetics. And each of those points are very easy to refute. Even at the individual level, the relevance of genetics in IQ has been hugely overstated, which is not to say there's no genetic component. I think just about every aspect of human culture or activity has some genetic link, but it has been hugely overstated. And we can see that from twin studies. in the studies of separated identical twins, which are often, by the way, being funded by far-right organizations such as the Pioneer Fund, the few cases where identical, separated identical twins have been raised in very different class backgrounds, the IQs have varied hugely. I mean, in one case I looked at it was by 20 points, in another case by 29 points. That's a huge difference, and it's purely
the result. So you're saying in a twin study where the twins were separated at birth, you can sort of test the level of influence of genes, and if they were in a similar background, they did pretty similarly, but if they were in a different socioeconomic background, you could see the difference of that environment?
Yes, absolutely. And we can see the same thing with adoption studies, where people have been adopted from poor backgrounds, where their parents came from poor, chaotic backgrounds, and then they've been adopted into working class homes. The IQs have raised, have gone up a little bit. When they've been adopted into middle class homes, the IQs have gone up further. And when they've been adopted into kind of upper middle class wealthy homes, the IQs go up further. And it's because of the environment they're exposed to. And by the way, in many of those studies, those changes in IQ of these adopted children are permanent. They don't sort of peter out after childhood. But that's
Hang on a second. On this program, I've had many guests say to me over and over again that there have been genes identified that are linked to intelligence. About 500, I think, was the most recent one that I remember. And that at least 50% of our intelligence is related to genetics. And I've seen that over and over again in lots of different scientific outlets. Are you saying that's not true?
Yeah, I'm saying it's not true. I argue the point why it's not true in my book. What often happens is that, say, they use twin studies and they find, for example, that where you get two identical twins and they're raised in the same kind of middle class families, well, it's very likely they're going to have similar IQs because they're raised in the same kind of population. So in that sense, then you could say, well, IQ has a strong genetic component, but you widen the field and you find that the hereditary component goes down and down and down and down. So attaching a figure of 50% or 40%, as some do, or some say even 70%, is really meaningless because it depends absolutely on how that population is defined. If it's white middle-class people, yes, then the hereditary component of IQ might well be 50%. But broaden that to all Americans, and it falls drastically. Broaden that to the population as a whole, and it falls far, far further.
I want to ask you about the thing that's often thrown around, particularly in these online channels, when it's discussion of race and intelligence, that, you know, that scientists who argue that there's no difference between the races just don't like facing the uncomfortable truth that there is. And if we have a large or even a small part of our intelligence that is based on genetics, and we see variability of genetics in other areas, why should we not see genetic variability in races?
Okay, so then we're looking at genetics. And so,
and I, by the way, I am playing devil's advocate here.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
I should say that.
So we're looking at genetics then. And so one has to look at, well, what is intelligence and what could be intelligence genes? And most of the studies I've looked at, they're finding more and more genes implicated in intelligence. So currently the kind of most people who are looking in this area say there are more than 1,000 genes that are implicated in intelligence, but they're finding more and more genes with each study. So when it's talking about a vast network of genes, a whole machine system that is intelligence, it's a little bit like a Formula One racing car. Intelligence is a bit like the car's performance. It's a sort of emergent property of the whole system. And those thousands of genes or more than 1,000 affect intelligence. And there's no kind of dedicated module in which natural selection can act without affecting other traits. So, but like with this, the Formula One car, if you randomly tinker on it, it's not going to have kind of good results. And so it is with intelligence. And so once our brains reach their physiological capacity, which would be affected by the size of our skulls and by the birth canal, then probably intelligence was pretty much as gone as far as it could, or at least very close to that. And certainly the archaeological evidence backs that up.
Are we ever going to get close to a test that really does properly give us an idea of rounded intelligence? Or is that always going to be elusive because of culture, because of environment, because of language?
Yeah, I don't think there's any test that can give us a general idea of intelligence, because I don't think intelligence is reducible to a single number. Now, I'm not saying IQ tests are not useful. They certainly correlate to performance in certain maths tests, in certain careers, because they're testing the same kind of thing. But this idea of intelligence being reducible to G, as it is for general intelligence, which IQ tests assume, I think is barking up the wrong tree. I think intelligence is a far more complex thing, and there are many different kinds of intelligence as well.
Gavin Evans, author of Skin Deep: Journeys in the Divisive Science of Race, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.